Good evening. The United States blames Iran for an attack on oil tankers approaching the Straits of Hormuz.
United States government that the Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the attacks that occurred in the Gulf of Oman today.
And a victory for tenants in Albany. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Thursday, June 13th, 2019. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced on Thursday the United States had determined Iran was responsible for an attack on two tankers near the strategic Straits of Hormuz, where oil from the Persian Gulf transits to world markets. While Pompeo gave no direct evidence of Iranian involvement, he made the argument that the Middle Eastern nation was responsible because of the level of sophistication of the assault. The two tankers were left adrift in the Gulf of Oman, driving up oil prices and stoking fears of a new confrontation between the two nations.
It is the assessment of the United States government that the Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the attacks that occurred in the Gulf of Oman today. This assessment is based on intelligence, the weapons used, the level of expertise needed to execute the operation, recent similar Iranian attacks on shipping, and the fact that no proxy group operating in the area has the resources and proficiency to act with such a high degree of sophistication. This is only the latest in a series of attacks instigated by the Islamic Republic of Iran and its surrogates against American and allied interests. And they should be understood in the context of 40 years of unprovoked aggression against freedom-loving nations. On April 22nd, Iran promised the world that it would interrupt the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz. It is now working to execute on that promise. In early May, the Revolutionary Guard Corps attempted the covert deployment of modified dhows capable of launching missiles. On May 12th, Iran attacked four commercial ships near the Strait of Hormuz. On May 14th, Iran-backed surrogates attacked by armed drones struck two strategically important oil pipelines in the Saudi Arabia. On May 19th, a rocket landed near the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. On May 31st, a car bomb in Afghanistan wounded four U.S. service members, killed four Afghan civilians, and wounded bystanders. Yesterday, Iranian surrogates fired a missile into Saudi Arabia, striking the arrivals terminal of an international airport, injuring 26 people.
And crude oil prices spiked more than 4% after the attack stoked fears disruptions could impact oil flows from the Middle East. Prices later settled about 2% higher. Washington accused Tehran of being behind a similar attack on May 12th on four tankers in the same area. Meanwhile, the president's interview Wednesday night with ABC's George Stephanopoulos has been stirring a hornet's nest on Capitol Hill. Trump had told the newscaster that he would not turn down help from a foreign power in an election bid when asked if he would report such contacts to the FBI.
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it.
And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi responded on Thursday that Trump's remarks were amoral and self-serving.
What the president said last night shows clearly, once again, over and over again, that he does not know the difference between right and wrong. And that's probably the nicest thing I can say about him. If he doesn't know the difference, it could explain some of his ridiculous behavior. And now to invite further involvement of foreign governments into our election. There was an assault on our democracy, an assault on our country by the Russians. That has been clearly documented by the intelligence community. And the President of the United States, instead of coming to the defense of our democracy, has said it's a hoax.
But House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy defended Trump's remarks, but said he didn't think the president would invite foreign intervention in an election.
I've watched this president stand up against these foreign entities, and he would not allow any foreign country to interfere in our elections.
So no comment on his words yesterday?
I think if you ask the president, he would be very clear about it, not allowing any foreign countries to interfere in our elections.
Mr. Leader, Speaker Pelosi has said that she's going to bring a package of bills to the floor that will do, among other things, basically require people to report to the FBI if a foreign government offers them assistance. Now, is that something you could vote for, and do you think you're confident?
Yes, I could vote for it. I would hope she'd hold that same standard to the chair of the Intel Committee, because she appoints the chairman of the Intel Committee. So I hope she would hold that standard. I hope she would hold that, have that same standard to her own party. Her own party, who used more than $6 million to pay a foreign individual to go drum up information.
Other Republicans tried to put some daylight between themselves and the president. The chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, said that wasn't one of his best statements before trying to defend Trump's words as part of his refreshing habit of saying what he thinks. Meanwhile, Trump announced on Thursday that the White House press secretary will depart the West Wing. Trump tweeted, "After 3.5 years, our wonderful Sarah Huckabee Sanders will be leaving the White House at the end of the month and going home to the great state of Arkansas." On the medical care front, on Wednesday, supporters of Medicare for All notched a victory when one of Congress's most powerful committees debated the progressive proposal, but the venue also gave Republicans an opportunity to paint proponents as socialists. Democrats and Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee were at odds with each other and at times with the lively audience of Medicare for All advocates over how to pay for a program that's estimated the cost in the tens of trillions of dollars. GOP lawmakers zeroed in on Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal's Medicare for All bill, which has 112 co-sponsors in the House. They compared the proposal to countries like Romania and claimed that single payer would hurt children and seniors. While the debate was short on substance, it was the first time a congressional committee with jurisdiction over health care issues had held a hearing on the proposal. Representative John Lewis of Georgia says the country's current health system is just plain unjust.
As long as I live, I will fight with every ounce of strength, every breath in my body, to make this right a reality. There's not a person in this country whose family has not known illness or injury. For too long, they have struggled. They are fed up, tired of a health care system that is not right, not just, and not fair. Access to care should not depend on the size of your wallet or the digit in your zip code. We must do more. We must do better. And we can and we will. In 1865, the 13th Amendment freed our ancestor from slavery. Almost 100 years later, those of us who took part in the Civil Rights Movement were still marching in the street, still fighting for equal rights. We've come a long way, but we still have much work ahead. Mr. Chairman and members of the Ways and Means Committee, we play a special role. We need to stand up, fight for those who are not as healthy and not as wealthy. We need to speak up for those who feel left out and left behind. We must ask ourselves, what would these bills look like in 100 years?
Medicare for All proponents aren't just pressuring Republicans. They're also calling on Speaker Nancy Pelosi to allow a floor vote on the measure, arguing that Democratic leaders should be taking the proposal seriously given the number of backers in the 2020 field of presidential contenders. Several Democrats running for president support the Senate version of Medicare for All, sponsored by Senator Bernie Sanders, a White House hopeful. And in Oakland, California, fans of psychedelic drugs are celebrating a new law passed by the city council that decriminalizes certain entheogenic drugs, a class of psychoactive substances that induce any type of spiritual experience aimed at development or sacred use. They include magic mushrooms, ayahuasca, and peyote, among others. Carlos Piazzola is founder of Decriminalized Nature Oakland. He says the law will take the paranoia out of the trip and allow more research into hallucinogenic drugs.
This is the city council deprioritizing the expenditure of resources towards any kind of enforcement against these plants and fungi, otherwise known as psychedelics. So this is a very inexpensive way to send a message to the federal government, state government, and many communities throughout the U.S. can do this relatively easily. Cost us about $10,000 to do it, as opposed to $15 million to do a statewide ballot measure. The decriminalizes here locally with respect to local law enforcement agencies to deprioritize any arrests or investigations having to do with entheogenic plants and fungi. It becomes a low arrest priority, so chances are you would not be arrested for that from the local enforcement agency, similar to what happened with cannabis back in 1996 here in Oakland.
What exactly are these substances that are addressed by the law?
So the well-known substances are ayahuasca, cacti, San Pedro, mescaline, peyote, mushrooms, and ibogaine. Any plant on the federal Schedule 1 list would be decriminalized here in Oakland.
Was there any opposition to it?
We had no opposition.
How do you explain that?
We launched a very strong and effective education campaign based on actual science that's out there, actual studies that are out there that have come out of the cannabis decriminalization, which we see a lot of the fears were really based on hype. So we use a lot of that pre-existing information, as well as the science that exists now with respect to psychedelics that's been around for quite a while. And then recent information, we shared all that with council. We did a pretty strong education campaign. By the time the council came to vote, they were very well informed. In fact, our deputy chief of police was talking about tryptamines and compounds that are contained in these with our local scientists. We're very impressed at the level of knowledge and understanding within our enforcement agency and within our elected officials. We anticipated that this level of support would emerge because we see that there is a very strong sort of enlightening process happening throughout the U.S. in response to the dark clouds that are being brought forth by the current administration.
Could you describe the different ethnogenic compounds and why they're so important? Do they provide some sort of medical assistance for people? Do they have a purpose besides just the freedom to use them?
Yes, these compounds are definitely healing and have been healing for many years. We know that a recent study by UC Davis in June of 2018 that came out in Cell found these compounds, including DMT, support the growth of dendrites and axons in the neural network and allows us to override what's called our default mode network, which is entrenched way of processing information, particularly while under stress or duress. It confines our responses, and in many cases, people are bound by a fear response, an anxiety response. These compounds allow us to grow our neurons in other parts of our brain and have responses that are beyond the default mode network or beyond pre-programmed responses. So they're actually very potent plants and compounds. So they include compounds, phenethylamine, tryptamines, and ergolines. Ergolines is LSD, excuse me, that's not part of the plants, but certainly tryptamines and phenethylamines. And they have a very strong effect in enabling greater capacity and for one to create their own healing narrative.
Is Oakland going to become the mecca of people who are interested in doing these substances?
We hope that we can become a mecca in education and information and enabling other communities to pass similar resolution in terms of use. We hope that through our education information process, people can find safe and responsible ways of using these throughout the U.S. and that we can get the support of the federal government to lift their federal restrictions on them so they can become broadly used all over scientific research institutions in the U.S. and in the U.K. They're finding tremendous healing effects from these plants. And so we hope that the entire U.S. can become a place of extensive use of these plants and fungi. In Oakland, we're going to do what we can to educate.
Carlos Piazzolla is founder of Decriminalize Nature Oakland. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. On Friday, the New York State Legislature expects to pass a gaggle of rent reform laws that will undo years of landlord-supported assaults on tenant protections. Governor Andrew Cuomo has promised to sign the bills. On Saturday, the rent laws would have expired, but among the new reforms is a measure that makes rent regulation permanent in the state. The new state rent reforms include the abolition of vacancy decontrol and vacancy bonus, limiting of rent increases for major capital improvements, preventing landlords from raising rents to the maximum level when leases are renewed, allowing cities and towns across the state to opt into the Good Cause Bill and requiring state inspection of some building improvements. New York State Assembly member Linda B. Rosenthal represents Hell's Kitchen and parts of Manhattan's Upper West Side. She says landlords are screaming, but it's time for renters to celebrate.
Friday is when we're going to vote on it. And I'm very, very happy, as are tenants across the state, advocates who have fought for so many years, and legislators who've also fought for many years. I think we are very happy with the provisions. First of all, it makes this every 4 year fight unnecessary because we've made these rent laws permanent, which is wonderful. We don't have to be held hostage like we have been in the past by the real estate industry that had the Senate Republicans in their control. So it's permanent. We repealed vacancy decontrol, which was the single largest reason that apartments were taken off the affordable housing list. Landlords would harass tenants out. They'd do huge MCIs. The tenants wouldn't be able to afford the rent. And so the goal was to decontrol the unit. Now that will be impossible, which is another awesome thing. Something that I have fought for years was changing the formula by which rent-controlled tenants have their rents increased, and these are mostly very elderly people in rent-controlled apartments whose rent has gone up 7.5% every time it was increased. And they also had to pay a fuel pass-along. So these were enormous charges for people on fixed income where nothing in their lives went up 7.5%. So that's gone, and that is wonderful. We also changed the MCI formula, so 2% is the cap of what can be charged for the new roof. It will be paid over 30 years. Also, people will get their rents decreased on MCIs that they're now paying. So their rents will go down.
What's an MCI? Let me just ask you briefly for folks who might not know what that is.
It's a major capital improvement. So the way the system was set up is that a landlord would have a new roof or some other, a new boiler, a new elevator, and then submit an application to Department of Housing and Community Renewal here in the state. I think about 98% were approved, when many of them were false. Either the work didn't happen or it didn't cost as much as the landlord said. But in any event, the tenant was on the hook for paying percentage of that forever. I have a right now in my district a building where the landlord put in so many MCIs that they might end up paying $100 a room extra to pay for all the work they did. And this is a blatant attempt to get the tenants out, because who can afford that? So there will be limits on MCIs, and there will be limits on how much can be charged to the tenant to help pay for them. That's a remarkable victory. We also beefed up some of the rights for tenants across the state. Right now, they have no rights, and now they'll be able to pursue a new lease if the landlord wants to get rid of them for complaining about conditions, for example. So we did give them some new rights. Owner occupancy is something landlords have used to get people out, saying, I need this apartment for my cousin, I need that apartment for my nephew, and we limited it to one. So there's many changes in this, and we are very, very happy. Once it gets passed on Friday, it's up to the governor to sign it. He challenged us, and he said, why don't you pass something, and whatever you give to me, I will sign. I think he was gambling that we wouldn't pass anything, and then he'd have a larger role in crafting something that perhaps the real estate industry would not hate as much as they hate this. And they do. They are reeling. They think that the sky's going to fall down. But I say to them, you know, the tenant sky has been down for like 20 years, more than 20 years, and it's time to set the balance. And right now we have taken back most of what we lost in 1997. Could we have done more things? Not right now, but there's next year, and there's plenty of room to expand on these rights. But what we got here is historic, and everyone's very happy.
The owners are saying that this is going to impact investment and construction and things like that.
You know, that's not true. I mean, owners want to invest in their property, make sure that it retains its value and it goes up in value. They will still be allowed to do repairs, and they will still be allowed to do MCIs. They just won't get as much back for it as they want. Ultimately, it's the landlord who makes the profit when they sell the building, not the tenant. And they have an obligation to keep their building in proper shape and provide a habitable environment for their tenants, some of whom pay dearly to rent a studio, for example, or a one-bedroom. Tenants pay so much, and so many tenants are rent burdened, which means they pay more than one-third of their income on rent. So it's time for the tenants to be in the driver's seat. Landlords have been for far too long. I think they're making all this noise to try to convince the governor not to sign the bill, and that's why you hear all of this doom and gloom from them. But I don't think it's going to work, because he said, pass a bill and I will sign it. And I think that's what will happen. And that's what must happen, so he keeps his word.
New York State Assembly member Linda B. Rosenthal represents Hell's Kitchen and parts of Manhattan's Upper West Side. There are close to 1 million rent-regulated apartments in New York City, but since the 1990s, at least 300,000 rent-regulated units have been lost because of vacancy decontrol. And in local news, a new report by the NYC New York City Campaign Finance Board analyzed New York City voter registration and data. It found that voter turnout and registration rates among New Yorkers rose significantly in 2018 for the first time since 2002. Kevin Barnum reports.
In a Lower Manhattan conference room, members of the Campaign Finance Board gathered to deliver the encouraging news about New York City's high voter turnout.
One thing that wasn't a huge surprise to anyone watching was just the spike in turnout in the midterm year. And what we saw was voter turnout looked much more like a presidential election year than it usually does. Usually midterm years look more like city elections.
Amanda Melillo is the Deputy Director of Public Affairs for the New York City Campaign Finance Board.
This was our first time we really got to drill down into demographic factors and what is impacting neighborhood turnout at a local level. I mean, one thing that I think was heartening was we found that more diverse neighborhoods actually had a high turnout. The percentage of African American, Latino, or Asian American citizens in a neighborhood had a positive impact. One thing that we found pretty consistently was that areas where you had higher percentages of people with less than a four-year degree from college had lower turnout. This was not necessarily a trend you see in every election. Usually income matters more, but in this past election, education mattered more. And finally, I think the thing that stood out to us the most is that we found the percentage of naturalized citizens in a neighborhood actually had a negative impact on turnout. I think we have tended to think it's limited English proficiency, but we actually found that doesn't have an effect. We've always assumed that might be a barrier to the polls, but now we're looking into whether it's in fact something different than we thought it was.
Melillo is often asked about how Donald Trump affects voter turnout.
I mean, I get asked this a lot, and I mean this in the most nonpartisan researcher way possible, because, you know, people have always asked to what extent is the president driving turnout, and I say, you know, normally it's very hard to like point to something in research or in these broad demographic trends of like, yes, this is definitely why turnout is going up in this election. I think we all have theories. But honestly, I mean, if you look at how these really diverse neighborhoods are turning out, I do think that is a response to what's going on the national stage. I can't prove it statistically, but that is my working theory based on what the numbers are saying.
The Campaign Finance Board expects voting turnout to be even higher in the future, with new voting reforms that passed by the new Democratic majority in the state Senate earlier this year. These include establishing an early voting period, consolidating primary election dates, and automatically updating a voter's registration when they move anywhere within New York State. In addition, by 2020, 16 and 17-year-olds will be able to pre-register to vote, with more reforms on the way. Kevin Barnum, WBAI News, New York.
And Elizabeth Lederer, the lead prosecutor in the Central Park 5 trial, resigned her position at Columbia Law on Wednesday, attributing her decision to a Netflix series that depicts law enforcement's railroading of five teenage boys in a brutal rape case in 1989. In a letter explaining her departure, Jillian Lester, dean of Columbia Law, said that Ava DuVernay's When They See Us had reignited a painful and vital national conversation about race, identity, and criminal justice. It also catalyzed Lederer's exit. Lederer said in a statement, given the nature of the recent publicity generated by the Netflix portrayal of the Central Park case, it's best for me not to renew my teaching application. And finally, the monumental staircase at Franklin Delano Roosevelt Four Freedoms Park is getting a rainbow makeover for Pride. From June 14th to 30th, the massive steps of the Roosevelt Island State Park will transform into a 12-by-100-foot rainbow-hued flag in honor of World Pride, the annual celebration of the LGBTQ community. Located on the southern tip of Roosevelt Island, the park is the last work of iconic 20th century architect Louis Kahn and celebrates the four freedoms: speech, worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear, declared by President Roosevelt's famed 1941 State of the Union speech. The park will launch the installation Saturday, June 15th, with a hashtag Ascend with Pride event, a free, family-friendly Pride celebration from noon to 6 p.m. Visitors are invited to a picnic on the lawn with food, wine, and beer available for purchase, while Drag Queen Story Hour will read books that focus on diversity and inclusion.
The other day they waited. The sky was dark and faded. Silently they stated, he has to die.
And that's some of the news for Thursday, June 13th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Kevin Barnum. Our engineer is James Irsay. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.
The summer sun looked down on him. His mother could, but no one did. Only on the sun. But it doesn't seem to matter. Mind remained unbended. He had to know.